Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to have some extra politics, or maybe some extra reality. We usually do two or three segments, but we have four for you today. This is the busy season for politics, and there's a lot to pack in. We also have a musical theme this week. It is beloved TV show theme songs, beloved by me, because it's my show. And, you know, if you like the theme to MASH, you can get your own radio show. This week, we'll speak with LA Times reporter Matt Pierce about the Somali community in Minneapolis. All you ever hear about them is terror, radicalization. He went there to cover a terror trial and found a lot of hardworking people trying to live the American dream. It's not the usual story we hear about Somalis in Minneapolis. Then we'll be joined by Princeton University political scientist Christopher Aiken. He wrote a piece with Larry Bartels this week in the New York Times arguing that Sanders supporters aren't necessarily in love with his policies. And before you get your, you know, defenses up, they're talking about more general principles, and it applies to Sanders in the case of their op-ed in the New York Times, but they're actually talking about how people select candidates more broadly. The reason we have four segments is that I thought we should cover the State Department Inspector General's report on Hillary Clinton's emails, but I just couldn't face talking about it for 10 or 15 minutes, so I got in touch with Ed Kilgore from New York Magazine and said, hey, Ed, you want to do a short segment bringing us up to date? And he was game, so we're going to do that. Finally, one of our favorite regulars, Heather Digby Parton, will drop by to chew the fat. We'll talk politics, of course. But first, let's talk about privilege. White privilege, or maybe cowboy privilege. The Bundys, Cliven and his sons, Ammon and Ryan, are, as you know, in jail awaiting trial on a host of federal charges related to their penchant for armed insurrection. Some families, they do, you know, hobbies. Some like bowling. Some like to go fishing. They like armed insurrection. And see, they don't recognize the federal government, but that doesn't keep the federal government from recognizing them. That's why they're in prison. So an ostrich can bury its head in the sand, but we can still see the ostrich's body. That's how it works. Anyway, the Bundys filed a complaint this week griping about how unfree prison is. It's just not a place that's known for its freedoms. But I guess these guys hadn't heard that before committing a slew of serious felonies. Here are some highlights from Ryan Bundy's complaint, and I quote, he writes, my rights are being violated. My right to life is being violated. All of my First Amendment rights are being violated. My right to freedom of religion is being violated. And I should interject here that they're Mormons, and Mormons wear special undergarments, and he's complaining about his right to his freedom of religion being violated. Jail officials said they could indeed wear their undergarments if their lawyers laundered them. So the jail isn't going to wash their dirty religious underwear for some reason. I don't know why. Anyway, it gets better. My right to freedom of speech is being hampered by monitoring and recording. Right? They're being recorded. They're prisoners. My right to freedom of assembly is being violated. I'm not allowed to see my brother and move about. He can't move about in prison. He continues, yesterday I attempted to discuss these issues with the U.S. Marshals, and they said these were simply the jail rules. Why should the Bundys be subjected to the jail rules just because they committed a bunch of very serious felonies? This violates my right to freedom of assembly. My Second Amendment rights are being violated. I never waived that right. He never waived his right to bear arms. It's so unfair that they won't let these guys keep their guns in jail. He also whined that, and I quote, there's no Wi-Fi within the jail facility and no ability to provide a hard internet connection. They are violating his right to Wi-Fi. It's right there in the Constitution, folks. We all have a right to Wi-Fi. Now, remember that this all started because these millionaire ranchers refused to pay heavily subsidized rates to graze their cattle on property that they do not own. That sent them into a fury. They threatened law enforcement officers with assault weapons. They took over a wildlife refuge randomly in Oregon. They were busted, and they are now whining about the fact that they don't get to play with their guns or surf the internet in jail. That, folks, is privilege. It's privilege turned up to 11.
We need that extra push over the cliff. You know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
Anyway, we'll take a quick break and then we'll be right back. And this next song is dedicated to the Bundy Boys at the Multnomah County Detention Center.
No price on your head, no.
Don't do it.
No, no. Don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. I always look forward to my next guest's bylines. Matt Pierce is just a good, smart reporter for the LA Times, and he often offers a kind of unexpected angle on the news. Last week, as he describes it, he parachuted into a Minnesota community to report on a trial of three Somali Americans on terror charges, specifically plotting to join the Islamic State in Syria. But he ended up with a different story, which listeners can Google. The title is, "I was just another reporter sent to cover radicalization in Minneapolis. Then two local Somalis took me on a tour." Matt Pierce, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So there is a first and second generation immigrant community in Minneapolis, a Somali immigrant community. You write that they are about 30,000 strong. Tell us a bit about what you experienced reporting this story.
Well, I had sort of a strange sequence of events. I went from covering this opening statements in an ISIS trial happening up there, which is a big deal, because if the government's case is, true and accurate, it would be a window into, how the Islamic State recruits young men from the U.S. to go over and fight in Syria. But, as I was sitting there in the courtroom, I just had this feeling like, I just really don't know that much about a Somali community. And so I decided that I just really needed to do my 101 and just go out in the community, talk to people, figure out what the other issues were. And so I just went to Cedar Riverside, which is the heart of the Somali immigrant community in Minneapolis, and just sat down at a family restaurant and then bumped into this guy named Mohammed Mohammed. He was a refugee. He came to the U.S. In 2014. And really, before I knew it, he's like, "Hey, man, you really got to come to this cafe and meet my friend." And I ended up going to this cafe and then getting taken on this several-hour tour of the local Somali community. These guys, Mohammed Mohammed and Burhan Elmi, both from Somalia, they just showed me around the local businesses and introduced me to business owners and took me one of the local Somali malls. And I ended up getting a sort of an inside look at a community that I think, from my perspective as a national reporter for, mainstream news outlet, a lot of times the only time we really, kind of write about this in my community is these occasional cases in recent years where, you know, someone has been charged with terrorism or is being investigated for being part of a plot. And I felt like I wanted to get a sense of, you know, this whole community that exists there, you know, 30,000 people, at least in Minnesota alone, who are, you know, they're living their lives, starting businesses, and they have all these other issues, you know, dealing with high rates of unemployment, but at the same time, starting businesses, learning English, and sort of reshaping the fabric of Minneapolis's civic identity. So it was a really interesting trip for me, and ended up turning into just sort of a tour of some of the people that I met there. I mean, I don't normally write in the first person, but I thought that maybe that might have been, you know, one of the better ways to kind of show people what it's like, you know, just to go to the community outside of the context of writing about radicalism, outside of the context of writing about terrorism, and just, you know, talk to people about the way that they live their lives. You know, it's the community is there. It's just not talked about a whole bunch outside of Minneapolis media.
And it has some bearing on the recent debates that we've had over refugees from other parts of the country, from other parts of the world, from Syria, from Iraq. There are Somali communities. There are also largely refugee communities in Atlanta, Georgia area, and around Lewiston, Maine. So let me ask you this. It seems like you found a fair degree of pride, of kind of civic pride. They took you around. They said, this is a business owned by Somalis. There's a business owned by Somalis. What did the folks you spoke to think about the media's coverage of their community? Because as you said, it's usually, you know, they are reported on for radicalization, full stop.
Right, right. I mean, mostly people I would say I encountered, I mean, they were very nice to me, and I had the benefit of, you know, essentially having a couple of guides who introduced me to people and you know, said I was okay, and so people could talk to me and, you know, kind of give a little bit, I guess it made them feel a little bit more at ease that I was, you know, being introduced to them in circumstances other than approaching them on the street and asking them about the Islamic State, which is, you know, can be off-putting for anybody because, you know, as with pretty much any minority group in the United States, a lot of times you might find yourself put in a position where you have media coming to you and sort of demanding that you answer for, you know, behavior allegations against, you know, maybe a couple of members of the community. And then there's just the dynamic of the whole community fearing it's going to be put in a bad light because of the way that somebody acted. And so that can lead to a kind of defensive mentality about the media. So, yeah, a lot of people I talked to just told me that they distrusted the media. They felt like they didn't accurately portray what life was actually like in the community. And they were telling me one story about how apparently Fox News had come to one of the apartment complexes where a lot of Somalis live, and they were doing a segment about the Islamic State trial. And so the news crew was trying to interview Somalis going in and out of the apartment complex, and no one would talk to them. And they're like, oh, you know, it's like Somalis here, they don't even speak English. And one of the guys joked to me, it's like, people speak English, just that they don't want to talk to Fox News. They're smart, you know? And that's what he said to me. You know, because, yeah, I mean, they really do fear the media. And I talked to one woman who, you know, she didn't, she gave me her name, but then she was like, no, actually, I don't want you to print it. And so I didn't end up quoting her in my story, but she was just telling me, you know, we can't trust the media. They twist our words. But, you know, at the same time, it's, you know, they view the Islamic State and they view radicalization as a real issue in the community. It's something that people talk about a lot, but you know, it's the dynamic's different because it's hard to have those conversations in public because I think they can feel the pressure of, you know, the broader community of Americans who don't really understand them or don't understand the internal dynamics of the community. You know, it's really hard to have kind of those harder conversations out in public where, you know, those kind of things you say can be used against you and punish you or taken out of context. So I think that's sort of the fear that you see in the community when they're dealing with the media and sort of dealing with how they're portrayed in the outer world.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when white college kids riot after a football game, nobody ever asked white community leaders to condemn the violence. So you mentioned that they see radicalization as a serious problem, but I actually got the sense that they see it as a symptom of other problems. Is that right?
Yeah, one of the things that I heard over and over again was these community like members just say, we need more jobs. We need to have something that will help give our kids direction. And the dynamic they sort of mentioned is that a lot of younger women in the community end up doing better in school. They have more focus. They seem to be having more success at college, a little bit more driven. But, you know, some of the younger men seem a little bit more listless and lack focus. And, you know, poverty is pretty high overall for Somalis in Minnesota. Lack of access of jobs is an issue. So there is an economic angle to this picture that plays very strong for them, because they feel that, you know, if you have, you know, someone who's with the Islamic State in Syria, you know, there were a couple of Somalis from Minnesota who ended up making it over to Syria and joining the Islamic State. You know, if you have these guys who were members of the community now over in Syria who are fighting in a war, you know, they can make that sales pitch to maybe some of the guys they knew back in Minneapolis, like, hey, you know, it's like, here, I'm important, I'm fighting, you know, it's exciting, you know, you could tap into the religious argument of, you know, this being really something that, you know, satisfies elements of their faith, then that can be an enticing recruiting pitch for a young guy who's, you know, maybe having trouble getting jobs or earning money or finding some kind of direction in the community there. So that's something that the community members said to me over and over again. It's just like, we need jobs, access to education, something that can help give these young guys, and it's usually young guys, alternatives to, you know, radicalizing or joining the Islamic State, you know, because it's just, it's something that's exciting to them within that worldview. So,
and
yeah,
where you don't have a lot of other things to do. I mean, that's something that we hear again and again. We've talked a little bit about radicalization in European Muslim communities, and on this show, we've had a couple of segments about that as well. And you kind of hear, this is a running theme we hear again and again. Yeah. All right, let me ask you this, and we probably got like 2 minutes left. So you did the opposite of what most reporters do. You didn't focus solely on the terrorism. But you did cover the opening statements of this trial. We've had a number of civil liberties advocates on the show, a couple of defense attorneys whose clients were charged with terror-related offenses. And some of these cases were pretty dubious. You know, we had a defense attorney on who was defending a young man in California. The FBI had paid a fast food worker $50,000 to find terrorists at his local mosque. He had largely led this guy into a plot. And his attorney came on the show and said that he wasn't, the young man who was charged wasn't the sharpest tack in the box. So you have these kind of dubious charges, these dubious terror plots. And then at the same time, the FBI has certainly foiled much more serious, much more dangerous plots. Do you have a sense where this case falls on that spectrum, or you know, do you have a sense of the case?
I couldn't say I would come down on one side whether the claims are valid or not, but I can tell you that certainly the defense for these three young men, they have three separate attorneys. Their arguments are that the FBI used a highly paid undercover informant who did have sympathies with Islamic State, but saw which way the wind was blowing when you know, the FBI started investigating. And so he flipped, turned state's evidence, and is now testifying against the three defendants and alleging that, you know, they're driving these sort of plots to go down to Mexico through, you know, San Diego or fly out of New York to Turkey and go join the Islamic State. And so their case is going to be, and I think they're about to start presenting defense's witnesses, that the government essentially turned a bad apple and used him as the crux of their sting operation. And he ended up encouraging these young men to try and go to join the Islamic State. Or they're also saying that, I think at least in the case of one or maybe two of the defendants, that, you know, they hadn't actually attempted to go and travel and join the Islamic State, but the FBI interpreted some of their other casual travel as attempting to join the Islamic State or trying to leave the country. So it's complicated. They're going through a few weeks of testimony and So I think we're a little bit ways off from jury deliberations, but certainly there is a fundamental challenge from the defense against the government's case saying that, you know, we think that you improperly used an informant, and we think that maybe you're interpreting the evidence wrong. And, you know, obviously the government thinks that, you know, these were a group of young men who joined the Islamic State. So that's currently the issue being hashed out in court up in Minneapolis right now.
Matt Pierce, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back with Christopher Akin, the political scientist from Princeton.
Come and listen to my story about a man named Jed. A poor mountaineer barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. Oil, that is, black gold, Texas tea. Well, the first thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. The kinfolk said, Jed, move away from there. Said, California is the place you ought to be. So they loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is, swimming pools, movie stars. The Beverly Hillbillies.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by Christopher Akin. Christopher is a Princeton University political scientist, and he co-authored a piece in the New York Times this week with Larry Bartels. Larry is from Vanderbilt University. It's titled, Do Sanders Supporters Favor His Policies? And it's based on the work that they did for their book, Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Government. Professor Akin, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be on.
By the way, you are at least the third Princeton political scientist to appear on this show, so good department over there. You argue in the piece that the common view that Bernie Sanders' success owes to his liberal policy positions is at best overblown. You say that it's guided by what you call the folk theory of democracy. What is the folk theory of democracy?
Well, the folk theory of democracy is what we hear on the 4th of July, which is that the United States government is controlled from the voting booth by ordinary voters, that we are thoughtful, well-informed, highly moral individuals who make decisions about who should lead us on a very rational, unemotional basis, and that's why we have a great form of government. Problem is that we have now 50 years of scientific evidence to demonstrate that that's not exactly the way things work, and the reason then that we're criticizing the folk theory is that we think we need a different way of thinking about democracy.
And I guess I should add that Professor Bartels, he did studies that found that senators' voting records were shaped largely by the interests of the wealthiest and very little by average working people, the interests of people who are not in that upper echelon. So this piece in the New York Times focused on Sanders supporters, but you're really talking about a more general phenomenon. People tend to think we align ourselves with politicians because we find their policies attractive. But you write, you and Larry Bartels write, and I quote, voting behavior is primarily a product of inherited partisan loyalties, social identities, and symbolic attachments. Over time, engaged citizens may construct policy preferences and ideologies that rationalize those choices. So you're basically saying that it's basically a chicken and an egg thing, huh? Can you unpack that a bit?
Sure. We wrote about Sanders because everyone already knows that Ted Cruz's supporters are disproportionately evangelicals. I was having a chat with a couple of evangelical clergy a couple of months ago, and they knew that Cruz was an evangelical, but all the other discussion about him and his policy positions and so forth was not the main thing they were thinking about. Similarly, we know that Clinton draws heavily from black and Latino voters. We know that angry white men are likely to vote for Trump, and so on. So everybody already knows this about all the other candidates. But in Sanders' case, a lot of people are still in the throes of the folk theory and imagine that his supporters are different. And we just wanted to argue that, like every other candidate this year, and like every other candidate in other presidential years, he's not an exception.
Now, I certainly agree that most voters don't calmly evaluate the candidates' platforms and determine whose policies best reflects their values. But I want to push a little bit in that I tend to think some policy issues can be powerful signifiers for those same social identities. So just for example, Sanders' call to break up the banks and reinstate Glass-Steagall could be central to his success in that it signals that he's the anti-establishment camp. He's part of this kind of larger anti-establishment tradition on the left. And I can certainly see how young people, you know, if they're swimming in college debt, could be really animated by his calls for tuition-free public colleges, just on the basis of their own experiences. Your thoughts?
Well, it's certainly the case that there are some policy voters out there. Sometimes they are single-issue voters, and they pay very close attention to that one thing. In other cases, they are paying attention to a broader spectrum of issues, but people like that are usually the exception. I think that you would find in a survey that the vast majority of American voters don't know what Glass-Steagall is, for example.
Right.
But you're certainly, and I would personally have a hard time going through its various provisions off the top of my head, to be honest. But the broader point you make, I think, is right. People are looking for signals about who's on which side, and they do have a sense of themselves as being a conventional Democrat, for example, someone who wants to be part of the usual Democratic coalition. People who think that way are voting for Clinton. People who are not, who don't call themselves Democrats, but are voting in the Democratic primary anyway, because independents are allowed in most states to vote in Democratic primaries, they think of themselves as outside the usual Democratic-Republican divide between the two-party establishments, and you're absolutely right. They're looking for signals of the kind of person who's outside that. On the Republican side, of course, it's Donald Trump who gets that.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Now, we had David Carroll on the show. He's one of the co-authors of The Party Decides, and he talks about the invisible primary where party actors, defined broadly, we're not just talking about people within, you know, working within the parties themselves, coalesce around a candidate very early on in the process. And so I wonder about an indirect relationship in the sense that these influencers, are they not very aware of policy? Are they not basing some of their allegiance on policy? So, I mean, we know that Hillary Clinton won the invisible primary, but a lot of the people who you would think of as leaders in the progressive movement, very early on, they embraced Sanders. So I guess my sense is that the lefty influencers are motivated by policy, and then people who identify with that faction follow their lead. Do you think that's right?
Absolutely. There's often what was called 50 years ago or more the two-step flow of communication, and there is signaling, and you do get a sense if you're looking for a signal, and a lot of us are. I look for signals on a variety of complex topics on which I'm not an expert, you know, how we should handle our nuclear stockpiles and things like that. I look for signals from people who are experts and whose judgment I trust, and a lot of voters do exactly that when it comes to picking candidates.
Now, you write, and I quote, "Many analysts have argued that Mr. Sanders' surprising support signals a momentous shift to the left among Democrats, but wishing does not make it so." My own sense is that Sanders didn't create this movement, but rather he tapped into something that was already growing within the party. It was called the Warren Wing before Sanders really gained prominence. Before Warren, I remember people talking about the Wellstone Democrats. And my question is, don't we have other sources of evidence of that shift to the left among Democratic voters and also lawmakers?
Well, I think the evidence on that is pretty mixed, to be honest. I'm old enough to remember the McGovern candidacy in 1972. I worked for Bobby Kennedy getting out the vote in 1968. So I go back a long time on that, and there was certainly a progressive left at that point.
I'm sorry. I should have clarified. I'm speaking about. You're absolutely right, of course, and we could go back to FDR. But since the 1990s, for example, since the first Clinton administration, mm-hmm. Don't we have other sources of evidence of that leftward shift?
It doesn't show up when you do survey research asking voters what they favor. There hasn't been a lot of movement on that score in that period. Of course, there are new issues coming along. The issue of breaking up big banks, for example, is one that didn't exist in 1990. So
right.
you can't do perfect comparison over time. But if you ask people about the standard kinds of issues, how much responsibility the government should have for ensuring that people have a decent standard of living and so on, there isn't much movement there. And so I'm inclined to think that the shifts that we see are examples of what is really a very long tradition in the Democratic Party of a split between, the Bobby Kennedy, Gene McCarthy wing versus the Hubert Humphrey wing in 1968. Mondale versus Hart in 1984, and so on, right down to the present. And I don't think that there has been a big shift in the relative sizes or the, enthusiasm for, let's say, for more socialist policies over that period.
What about DW nominate scores? They tell us that there's a significant move away from the center by both parties.
Well, that, of course, is right. There used to be liberal Republicans, and the district I live in has been represented by a Democrat now for more than a decade, but was a Republican district here in New Jersey. New Jersey used to be, in my youth, a reliably Republican state in presidential elections, and now it's reliably Democratic. And that's the shift in the Northeast, where liberal Republicans have died out to a large degree, and what's left is a Democratic majority. And in the South, the opposite's happened, of course. So taking that into account, the fact that there are those two centrist branches of the two parties have disappeared, that empties out the center, but it doesn't necessarily make the average Democratic member of the House or the Senate more left-wing in some absolute sense, apart from the disappearance of the so-called blue dog Democrats.
Right, right. Now, before I let you go, you write, and I quote, "The most powerful social identities and symbolic attachments in this year's Democratic race have favored Mrs. Clinton, not Mr. Sanders." Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, I mean that in particular, the attachment of minority voters, both African-American and Latino, to her, along with her stance as a representative of liberal women's aspirations, those have been very visible and quite powerful. I'm not sure that they are less important in Sanders' case, actually, but they're more subtle. They don't correspond to the standard demographic categories, and that's what we were talking about.
It's interesting that you point that out, given that there's been a lot of discussion about how African-American affinity for the Clinton brand, if you will, mm-hmm. isn't necessarily based on fondness for their policy preferences. They go back to longstanding kind of social connections that started out in Arkansas, very early in the Clintons' career. So I think that's an interesting point. Christopher Aiken, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for offering your insights to us today.
It's a pleasure. You asked good questions.
Thank you. Folks, you can read the piece at the New York Times. It's titled, "Do Sanders Supporters Favor His Policies?" Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Ed Kilgore from New York Magazine to talk about Clinton's emails because I'm sure you're dying to hear more about Clinton's emails. Welcome back to the show. I'm always happy to have Ed Kilgore on the show. Ed is a columnist for the for New York Magazine. Last time he was on the show, I think he was still at Washington Monthly as the political animal. Ed, have we had you on since you switched?
You know, I don't think so. I switched, basically a little before Christmas.
Last time we talked to you about your book, and that was after you switched.
Yeah, that was a while back.
So I'm not going to congratulate you on switching. Anyway, Ed has a piece this week, The Big Problem with How the Hillary Clinton Email Scandal is Being Covered. Once again, the emails are in the news. Ed, before we talk about the coverage, did we learn anything new with this Office of Inspector General's report?
I'm tempted to agree with Josh Marshall's characterization of it as a nothing burger. I guess we learned that the staff of the Inspector General of the State Department agrees that Hillary Clinton shouldn't have done her emails the way she did.
Okay.
That's a shock.
Yeah.
It really just depends on your point of view, which was kind of the point of what I wrote. It's become sort of a Rorschach test for people in politics. Everything that comes out on this is an aha moment for Hillary haters and Republicans. And what I really focused on in my piece, though, is how weird the certain elements of the mainstream media have gotten who are deeply invested in this story, you know, particularly the New York Times and Washington Post. It's just, you know, just sort of self-evident to them that this is the biggest thing ever.
And I mean, it's such a hard story to really understand what the contours is, isn't it? I mean, like, you know, what is it all about? Well, she had a private email server. It's hard to imagine that ordinary people would find that this is something that, that really resonates with them, right? I mean, do you think this is something
if there was any evidence of a security breach, if anything bad happening as a result of this, it might be another matter. But yeah, as it is, it's just one of these weird techno stories, that most people don't even grasp. And even for, you know, the Republicans that are jumping up and down about it, I mean, it's probably about a fifth order, you know, complaint about Hillary way behind Benghazi and, you know, Whitewater and Lord knows what else they think proves that Hillary Clinton should be put in prison. A quick tangent, when I was in Iowa covering the Republican caucuses there, I was amazed at how many of these people were wearing these buttons that said Hillary for prison and had a picture of her behind bars. That's the mindset.
Yeah, you know, H.A. Goodman believes that as well. He can't wait for the FBI to come and give Bernie the nomination. So, I mean, it's one of these things where it plays to, you know, preconceived notions that Hillary Clinton is untrustworthy on the one hand, right? It certainly added to that sense, and I think the polls show that pretty clearly. On the other hand, though, when I look at not only the obsession with the emails, but the fact that Donald Trump is talking about Whitewater, that Donald Trump is talking about Vince Foster, I mean, should we be optimistic that this is the best that they have?
Should be optimistic that what? Excuse me.
This is the best stuff they have. Like they just.
Well, maybe so. It does trouble me though, and this is what really I was writing about. That you know, very important elements of the news media, and again, I single out the Times and the Post, are treating, you know, what they think this shows about Hillary Clinton as equivalent to all of Donald Trump's many spins. You know, as I pointed out, sort of the worst you could say about what Clinton did is that it was reckless. Donald Trump is reckless 9 times a day, you know, as a matter of principle.
Right.
And I, you know, false equivalence is a real problem in our political system, and it's understandable because journalists want to seem even-handed. But in this case, it's really kind of grotesque. You know, mishandling emails versus, you know, threatening journalists to jail them. It's just not the same thing.
Ed, how concerned are you that the news media, in its quest for balance, is going to normalize Donald Trump, who is not a normal candidate?
I'm very concerned about that. It's already sort of happening. Anything the guy does to seem a little less crazy is treated as a big, important thing. You know, he's moving to the center. He's uniting the Republican Party. Everybody's coming around to him. He's not really all that bad. He never really meant it. I mean, these are the kind of insinuations you see in coverage of Trump every single day now. And again, it's understandable. You don't really want to think that, you know, one of the two major party candidates is a threat to the existence of democracy.
Right.
But I do think that some people that are now normalizing Trump ought to go back and look at some of their earlier writing about him and see if they think he's really changed or if they're just changing the context.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I recall after one of his victory speeches, Donald Trump referred to Senator Ted Cruz. And afterward on CNN, everybody said he was presidential because he didn't call him Lying Ted.
Exactly.
Which seems like a pretty low bar. We're setting a pretty low bar.
Well, and you could argue that Trump's smart enough to have figured out that if you set a low bar, then it's easy to get over it. It is kind of like, I mean, you know, even in 2012, when you were dealing with a normal candidate, it amazed me how easily Mitt Romney convinced everybody to decide he had moved to the center in the first debate with Obama after months and months and months and months and months of pandering to the conservative movement. So again, you know, whether it's a horse race mentality where people want it to be even, so it's exciting, or if it's just this false equivalence phenomenon I've been talking about, you know, either way, yes, there are a lot of forces trying to normalize Donald Trump, not least of whom, of course, are the many Republicans that were attacking him like he was Attila the Hun just weeks ago.
Yeah, between that,
including
and Clinton,
Marco Rubio, who now says he would be honored to speak on Trump's behalf at the Republican convention.
Real profile and courage from Marco Rubio. I think he should do it on a high chair.
little Marco, yep.
Ed Kilgore, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this week. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Josh.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to be right back with Digby Heather Parton. Stay tuned.
Here we come. The street, we get funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We're just trying to be friendly. I'll come and watch, sing and play. We're the young generation, and we got something to say. Hey, we're the monkeys. You never know where we'll be found.
Welcome back to the show. I'm always happy to have Heather Digby Parton on the show. Heather is, of course, a columnist at Salon, and she is the proprietrix of her own blog, Hullabaloo. Heather, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
You know, Heather, this is the first time that I've had the monkeys play you in.
I'm honored. In fact, they just did a 50-year reunion thing or something. I noticed they were playing here, and they had some kind of celebration here in L.A. for them yesterday.
I guess the bank accounts are a little light. Is that what you're saying?
Could be.
The royalties are not as rich as they once were. So, Heather, did you catch Jane Meyer's piece about James O'Keefe?
Oh, I did, yes. In fact, I think I wrote about it at some point, yeah.
Should we just underlie everything he does with a laugh track?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he is kind of like a walking joke. On the other hand, there were some things in that article that were very revealing, I thought, and also a little bit of a warning in there. For people who don't know, James O'Keefe, of course, is the sort of, what do they call him, gorilla. Dirty trickster, yeah, who is credited, and rightfully so, with destroying a very vital democratic institution called Acorn by faking some videotapes, which everybody then ran screaming, you know, threw their aprons over their heads and ran in circles going, oh, my God, oh, my God, and they ended up defunding them. But he has, subsequent to that, had a number of failed attempts at doing the same thing and continues to do so. Jane Meyer's story was very interesting because he was caught. I mean, this is how bad the guy is. He was caught doing one of his scams because he forgot to hang up the phone and left it on.
What a
on a
goofball,
voicemail,
right?
And
he's
ended
the Keystone
up having
Cops.
He had a meeting with the voicemail still on of someone he was attempting to scam, explaining the whole scam.
Yes.
And,
now, just we should give a little background for listeners. He apparently is obsessed with George Soros. There was a funder who specifically wanted to go after Soros. So he got in touch,
yes,
and he posed as somebody who wanted to donate or assist George Soros' democracy projects in Eastern Europe. And then he thought that he hung up, but he did not.
And went on to lay out the entire plan on the voicemail, which is, you know, unbelievable. You almost have to wonder, I mean, how could someone do that by accident? But apparently he did. And so Meyer, it's a fascinating story, really highly recommended. Go to the New Yorker and find it. But she goes and then does some, you know, as she does so well, she does some investigative journalism on him. And actually, he gives her an interview, and she goes to his headquarters, and he says that he's been funded with, according to her, he's got a couple million dollars to work with.
Yes.
And they're doing, you know, he says that they've got people inside the Clinton campaign, and he's got infiltrators everywhere. What was most interesting to me about the story, though, was not that, you know, his operation, it's obvious that he's not really running a top flight operation. There's so much money floating around in the 1% that they figure, hey, throw him a little bit, maybe he'll get lucky. You know, it's like some bad venture capitalist,
right,
deciding to fund him. But he said that, according to Meyer, she says that there are others like him, that there is, you know, and we know that there are, that Planned Parenthood group, the medical, you know, research center or whatever it was they called it, that did the fake, you know, quote, baby parts videos.
Yes.
That was, you know, that's another one. I mean, there, according to Meyer, there are others like O'Keefe who may actually be better at this. So it's something that I think people should be aware of and concerned about. And she did talk to David Brock, who is widely considered to be a similar actor on the left. And he's not. I mean, what he said, and he's, I think, you know, he seems fairly upfront about his agenda, which is, you know, to dog Republicans and track them relentlessly and in the media for, you know, for their lies and to call them out. But he says, you know, no, we do have limits. I mean, we're not going to be doing some of the things that these other people are. And I guess you can choose not to believe him. But it did seem to me that what his agenda is quite different than what anything that you might say that James O'Keefe is doing. So
I'm a bit wary of David Brock, I have to say, but I mean, at a minimum, they're competent over there. I mean, this guy is such a goofball. Let's recall that he was arrested breaking into Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu's office. He had to do community service. Can you imagine him doing 100 hours of, or whatever it was, community service? James O'Keefe on the side of some highway in an orange jumpsuit picking up garbage. It's just, and then, so he did actually score another scalp with PBS, right? They posed as Arabs and said, we'll give you a bunch of money if you say nice things about Islam. And Jay Meyer noted in the piece that even Glenn Beck looked at that recording and said it was deceptively edited. So it wasn't just like liberals saying that it was deceptively edited. But here's the thing. He screwed himself in that if you look at how he took down Acorn, there was widespread buy-in by neutral media, by the mainstream media, right? They're not going to get burned again. So, right, I'm on his mailing list. James O'Keefe sends out a big scoop every week. It's covered by like the Daily Caller and nobody else, and it has no effect, right? So other antics that he's done is he crossed the Rio Grande in...
That's my favorite. That one is my favorite.
A rubber Osama bin Laden mask. He crossed the border to show how porous the border is. He's being videotaped, right? There's this great picture of a guy holding a video camera and James O'Keefe in this goofy rubber Osama bin Laden mask. Then he had a big scoop, and they actually pitched this in a big way. Again, I'm on their mailing list. They said, oh, we caught the Clinton campaign doing campaign finance law violations, right? They posed as somebody from Canada and bought a t-shirt with cash. And this was the campaign finance violation. And then the other thing that they've done is they've been busted like two or three times committing voter fraud to prove that voter fraud exists. But what they've actually done is proven that you can't get away with voter fraud because they were busted.
They got caught each time. I know. And yet, for some reason, they didn't see that. They you know, they presented this as, look what we did. And yet each time they were caught doing it and obviously proving that you can't get away with voter fraud. I mean, it's hilarious. And, you know, obviously it's one of those right-wing grift operations at this point. I mean, we know that much. I mean, there's a lot of them out there of, you know, like you say, the mailing list. I'm on that mailing list, too. And it's always, you know, there's always an ask for money. And I'm sure that he's got some, you know, poor, you know, elderly folks in the Midwest who think that he's... that he's legit, and they send him money, and clearly they probably do have some you know, some kind of rich, you know, deep pockets donor out there who thinks that they might be able to destroy one of his enemies. I mean, one of the things people I don't think understand about the 1%, and this goes to Donald Trump as well. You know, people assume that they must be really smart people or they wouldn't be so rich. This is just patently untrue. I mean, there are a lot of rich people out there who are not very bright or who may, you know, have normal, you know, intelligence, but are so ideologically, you know, just extreme that they will believe this stuff and they will fund it. I mean, you have that there are people out there who will. I mean, and they have a lot of money. The assumption that somehow or another that this crackpot stuff can only be funded by, you know, little old ladies in Dubuque who don't know any better and are sending in their Social Security check. They do that, that's for sure, and it's really morally monstrous that they do it. But there are rich people who do the same thing, and it's always amazed me how either ideologically extreme some of these, you know, vastly wealthy people are. You know, they watch Fox News, too. Or how just plain dumb they are and actually buy into the same, you know, ridiculous scams that everybody, that others on the right do. So,
Trump obviously disproves the idea that we live in a meritocracy where rich people are, you know, rich because they're so smart. But I actually have seen in those rare interviews with Charles Koch. I've been left unimpressed with his intellect. Right? He seems like, and I'm sure he's not a stupid person because he's managed to, you know, obviously have one of the biggest companies in the world. Even if they inherited, they've clearly done the right things in business. But I was struck by, he just seemed like a Fox News watcher. He didn't seem particularly intelligent. Now, the thing about the reason that James O'Keefe keeps getting busted committing voter fraud, got arrested, sneaking into Mary Landrieu's office, he thinks, and I think he actually thinks this, that he's an investigative journalist from the right. And what I think about his whole shtick is that there's long been this idea of, like, you take the best tactics from your opponents and you adopt them yourself. And we know that the right-wing movement has done this, for example, with the labor movement. They looked at the labor movement. They said, how is this successful? How are these social movements successful? How can we emulate them? And I think that what O'Keefe is doing is he is trying to emulate certain tactics on the left, but they're not actual tactics on the left. They're what wing nuts think of the left. And they're what wing nuts think of in as far as mainstream journalists. He thinks mainstream journalists do this type of thing. And I have to add that James O'Keefe is a fan of Saul Alinsky, and I've never read Saul Alinsky. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
it's like the right is obsessed with Saul. He's a Saul Alinsky guy.
Well, it really interests me that they do that they evoke Alinsky all the time, because they
all
not
the
only evoke it, you know, that they evoke it themselves and say, you know, this is what Saul Alinsky, you know, says in his book, and they talk, you know, Rules for Radicals is the book, but they also condemn other people that, you know, they say Hillary Clinton is an acolyte of Saul Alinsky, which is hilarious. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure she probably did read it. I mean, she's a political person and probably
well,
in college or whatever she may
right,
have. Yeah, I mean, that was a big thing, you know, back in the 60s. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but I mean, obviously her career has been, you know, very much a standard mainstream political career, not anything radical,
right.
At least not by today's standards, it's not. I think people considered her feminism a little bit radical at the time, but, you know, by today's standards, it was very tame.
Yes.
But, you know, this idea somehow that you know, it's horrible what those people do, so we've got to do it too. I mean, that's always kind of amused me. It's a, you know, yeah. I mean, well, here's the better example is Grover Norquist in his group. He's a major fan of Lenin. And I'm not talking John Lennon. I'm talking Vladimir Lenin here. And he, you know, modeled, he and his crew, this is the people back in the early 80s, he and Ralph Reed and Jack Abramoff and that crowd, when they came in as, you know, low-level grunts in the Reagan Revolution, this was what they were Leninites.
Right-wing Leninites. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you this, I don't believe, and I may be wrong, I don't believe that many people on the left who are under age, I'm going to say 50, have read Saul Alinsky. I believe that it must be like 3%, right? They took a course, they read Saul Alinsky. Heather, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to chew the fat with me today. I appreciate that.
My pleasure, Joshua. Have a great weekend.
You too. I'd also like to thank Matt Pierce and Christopher Aiken and Ed Kilgore. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I want to thank Crooks and Liars for letting me keep the show over there, and Heather Digby Parton for letting me keep the show at her place. Of course, I want to thank all of you good people. Have a terrific week.